This is Audible.
The Gentle Eating Book. The easier, calmer approach to feeding your child and solving common eating problems. Written by Sarah Ockwell Smith and read by Katie Sobey. Introduction. What is gentle eating? We've all heard the saying, you are what you eat. However, for many parents, this could be more accurately phrased as, you are what your children eat. What children do or often don't eat can be a cause of anxiety, shame, and constant stress for parents. All too frequently, they pin their self-worth on their children's appetite and weight. Many parents tend to take pride in having raised a good eater and readily accept compliments about their children's table manners, believing that they are the result of good parenting. On the flip side, others worry that they have done something wrong if their baby slips off a weight centile, that their toddler won't eat anything green, or when their older child comes home with a letter from school saying that they have an unhealthy BMI and need to lose weight. Judgment from society abounds, too. We are all too quick to blame childhood weight problems on parents, when the issue is far bigger and far more alarming. For such a basic physiological function, eating conjures up so many emotions in parents. We live in an era of information overload, and when this is combined with such an emotive subject for parents, they simply cannot win. We are bombarded with advice about healthy eating, whether from government-sponsored leaflets and parenting magazines, or celebrity family cookery books and television slots featuring expert nutritionists. It is my firm belief, however, that these all do more harm than good, and all the while, stress overeating takes away from the enjoyment of parenting, ironically, often exacerbating the original problem. Too many books focus on trendy diets and complicated recipes. This book is not one of them. In fact, you won't find a single recipe here. Nor will you find discussions of superfoods, micronutrients, or clean eating. This book is different. Instead of providing recipes, nutrition advice, exercise motivation, and cookery tips, it will take you on a journey into the physiology and, most importantly, the psychology of eating. Along the way, we will cover many common concerns shared by parents. Topics covered include what to do if your baby is reluctant to eat solids or to take milk from another source when you are breastfeeding but returning to work soon, how to encourage your toddler to eat food that isn't a plain beige carbohydrate, especially vegetables, what to do if your toddler regresses in their eating, having been an adventurous eater in babyhood, and how to cope when they either don't stop eating, refuse to eat anything, or randomly swing between fasting and binging. We will also look at eating in school-age children, and how to cope with the imposition of school eating rules, weight-based bullying, persistent picky eating and overeating, and overweight. Finally, we will consider teen eating, including and especially dieting and eating disorders, and how to prepare your teen to live independently while still following healthy, gentle eating principles. While I have written this book with several specific, commonly faced eating issues in mind, it is equally applicable to those reading with no real eating concerns. If you have picked it up to prepare yourself for the journey ahead, rest assured there will be plenty in it for you, no matter how old your child is or how you have approached eating to date. To change your child's eating patterns, you must know why they are eating, or perhaps not eating, in a certain way. And I believe it is paramount to understand the basic physiology underpinning appetite, hunger, satiety, and taste preferences. Very often, eating behaviors that parents worry about are developmentally normal for the age of their child. Recognizing this can take a huge weight off the already heavily burdened shoulders of parents. Therefore, Chapter 1 will take you on a whistle-stop tour of the physiology of eating. I have written this book to help parents understand not only the way their children eat, and to gently nudge them towards more healthy, instinctive eating, but also their own eating patterns, and the effect modern society has upon them. It is impossible to separate these issues. They are inextricably intertwined. In fact, understanding the psychology of eating, the silent, unconscious, but perpetual messages we receive about it and the way we ourselves view food and eating is the cornerstone for understanding and changing our children's eating habits. For this reason, Chapter 2 is all about adult eating and our own relationship with food, and it is no coincidence that this chapter appears before any of those explaining eating in children. Put simply, to positively influence the eating habits of your children, you must understand and change your own. Even if you feel that you have a healthy attitude to food, I can guarantee that, subconsciously, you will have picked up on some erroneous beliefs and unhealthy habits from your own parents, friends, family, and other sources. Parenting forces us to look at ourselves more closely. Our own behavior and beliefs should always be the starting point for changing those of our children. So although you may be desperate to dive straight into the chapter relevant to your child's age, I would strongly urge you to listen to chapters 1 and 2 first to gain a far deeper understanding of the theory and tenets of gentle eating. The information in these chapters will help you to understand your own eating and that of your child, to avoid common eating pitfalls, particularly when it comes to the impact of your own behavior, and to gently steer your child towards a healthier eating pattern, whether you are already facing issues or are listening now in preparation. In chapters 3 to 7, we will consider eating within smaller age brackets, looking at common eating problems that parents face at each stage of child development. I have divided the book in this way to make it as easy as possible for you to listen to and, most importantly, make use of. What begins in babyhood often has implications for toddlerhood and beyond. I would therefore urge you, once again, to listen to as many chapters as possible because they are really all relevant, no matter how old your child is. My aim in writing this book is to empower you to empower your children. I hope to change your view of eating, to remove a lot of the stress surrounding it, and make it into something far less guilt-inducing and far more enjoyable. I hope to help you to raise children who are not only healthy in themselves, but who have a healthy relationship with food, for life. And the way to achieve this, I believe, is to embrace gentle eating. What is gentle eating? Throughout this book, and indeed in its title, I use the term gentle eating to sum up a healthy and relaxed ethos about eating. Gentle eating encompasses four main beliefs that apply in any situation and at any age. 1. Gentle eating is mindful. Being mindful of our eating requires us to focus on the whole experience. That means we are not distracted when we eat, and that we do not eat as a distraction. We eat when we are hungry, being aware of the signals our bodies are sending us, and we stop eating when we are full. We don't eat to silence uncomfortable emotions, and we are aware of any beliefs or conditioning from our own upbringing that may cause us subconsciously to repeat patterns of eating. From a parenting perspective, eating mindfully means dissociating food from not only your own emotions, but also your child's. It means not using food as a reward for being good or as a distraction to keep your child calm or quiet. And it means not labeling food as good or bad and being aware of how your own beliefs about eating can influence your children. Being mindful also means avoiding distractions at mealtimes, whether that's eating in front of the television or having intense conversations over the dinner table about something your child has or hasn't done at school. It also involves being aware of your own feelings around your child's eating and not taking their behavior personally or extrapolating it as a judgment of your parenting skills. 2. Gentle eating is empowering. Following gentle eating principles empowers all members of the family. Parents are empowered to trust their children and their own parenting skills based on a sound understanding and knowledge of normal, healthy eating. And children are empowered to follow their body's own signals and self-regulate their food intake rather than rely on instructions from their parents or messages from society. This will have far-reaching effects, including the possibility of empowering their own children in the future, and creates a positive spiral, enabling everyone in the family to feel more secure and confident. 3. Gentle eating is respectful. When parents understand the psychological and physiological effects and roles of eating, they can show true respect for their children. Far too many parents believe they are doing the best thing for their children by force-feeding them, rewarding, praising, chastising, and restricting their food intake. This erroneous belief unfortunately serves to disrespect children by misunderstanding them. The informed beliefs of gentle eating allow parents to afford their children the respect that they deserve. This, in turn, teaches children to respect their bodies and the marvelous things that they achieve every day, which can only be positive for their overall well-being and self-esteem. 4. Gentle eating is authoritative. When it comes to childhood eating, most commonly, parents fall into two camps. On the one hand, there are the authoritarians, who seek to control what their children eat. They restrict foods, often banning what they believe to be unhealthy or bad food. Portion sizes are prescribed, not too much and not too little. Plate clearing is often enforced and rewarded. Eating is done on a schedule, with routine meal times and consequences if the children don't eat well. Personal preferences and dislikes are not truly respected if they are believed to be unhealthy. On the other hand, there are the permissives, those who give their children full control, with little attempt to regulate any aspect of eating, particularly when it comes to choice of foods offered. Permissives may give up trying to offer healthy food or abandon all hope of any table manners. Permissive eating tends not to be mindful, and distractions often abound. For instance, eating while watching television to encourage the child to eat more. In the middle of these two styles is authoritative parenting. Authoritatives strike a balance between too much control and too little. They are informed and understand both the physiology and psychology of eating. They respect their children and seek to empower them through their eating by taking most of the control of some of the more mature aspects, such as choosing and preparing foods and deciding when to seek professional help. They don't attach emotions to eating, don't reward or punish. Instead, they encourage the development of self-regulation. Gentle eating is very much in line with authoritative parenting, and, in my opinion, it is the only approach that is mindful of the child's eating today, while also being concerned with their relationship with food in the years to come. Gentle eating can help not only to change our children's well-being for the better, but our own as parents too. It is sensible, intuitive, and, most importantly, supported by a growing body of scientific evidence, which I will refer to throughout the book. Gentle eating principles apply at any age, from the day your baby is born to the day your teenager leaves for college and beyond. In fact, you may find that a lot of information in this book is helpful to you too, as an adult. However, it is not a quick fix. It is a lifestyle ethos and requires a shift not only in the way you feed your child, but also in how you yourself think about food. To change children's eating for the better, we must first start with understanding what normal eating looks like and the physiological processes that govern it. Sometimes that means re-educating ourselves in order to change the way our children eat. And a wonderful and unexpected side effect of this is that often this knowledge can bring a new sense of freedom to our own relationship with food. Please note, the information contained here is not a replacement for medical advice. I have written this book presuming that your child is otherwise healthy, emotionally and physically. It does not cover medical or pathological extremes of eating, nor does it deal with specific psychological or physiological disorders. If you feel that your child's eating may require special attention, please listen to your instinct and seek professional medical advice from a qualified doctor. Chapter 1. The Physiology of Eating. Isn't it ironic that so many books, articles, television programs, and websites discussing healthy eating for children focus only on how to change eating, without helping parents to appreciate what normal eating looks like in the first place? If we don't know how hunger and appetite work, why taste preferences exist, and how our lives impact on them, how are we ever going to truly understand how to gently change the way our children eat? If you are listening to this book as preparation, having not yet experienced any problems, This chapter will help you to gently steer your child's eating on a positive course for the years to come. If you have a pre-existing worry or concern over your child's eating, then it will help you to uncover some of the root causes and to resolve the issue as gently and positively as possible. In my opinion, jumping straight into tempting healthy recipes is both naive and unhelpful. A basic introduction to the physiology of the eating process is needed first, because knowing how things work must always be the starting point. In this chapter, I will begin by looking at some of the most important language around eating, namely hunger, appetite, satiation, and satiety, comparing and contrasting these terms while taking a brief look at the physiology underpinning each of them. Next, I will look at certain influences upon our eating, especially sleep and stress. Following this, I will cover the physiology of taste and, importantly, taste preferences and cravings, a concept that we will return to throughout the book. This combined knowledge will provide a firm foundation from which to consider eating patterns at each age, from birth through to adulthood, as covered in later chapters. This chapter constitutes important foundation learning, whether you have a newborn on a milk-only diet, are struggling with a toddler who is reluctant to eat meals you have slaved over for hours, or are looking to avoid the perils of a dieting teenager. The physiology of hunger and satiety. Confusingly, when discussing hunger and its presence or absence, society often mixes up different terminology and concepts. To understand the physiology of hunger and satiety, the sensation of not being hungry, we must first differentiate them from other similar sensations, namely appetite and satiation. This is vital when considering gentle eating, because we cannot be mindful about something we do not truly comprehend. So, let's begin with a brief look at the terminology. Appetite is the word used to describe the response to a blend of psychological and physiological stimuli, such as smell, thought, memory, and preferences, which can lead the individual to begin or delay eating. Hunger need not be present for appetite to be heightened. Hunger is used to describe the intrinsic, uncomfortable physiological sensation caused by a lack of food, which leads the individual to seek it. Appetite is of less importance when true hunger is experienced. Satiation relates to the amount eaten during a meal. It describes the physiological and psychological responses experienced at the time of consuming food, resulting in sensations of fullness and satisfaction. Again, both physiological and psychological, leading the individual to stop eating. Satiety relates to the space between meals. It is about the level of fullness and satisfaction experienced by an individual after they have eaten, resulting in the inhibition of further eating for an amount of time, until hunger returns. While satiety is guided predominantly by physiological processes, psychological ones undoubtedly play a role too. How hunger occurs. Hunger represents the body's physiological need to consume more food. This need should be differentiated from wanting food. Hunger keeps us alive and our bodies functioning. It does not involve psychological preferences or desires. The most common symptom of hunger is a feeling of emptiness in the stomach, often accompanied by muscular contractions, or hunger pangs, and sometimes a growling or rumbling noise in the stomach. These symptoms originate in the stomach, which sends electrical signals via the vagus nerve to the brain. This effect is largely triggered by the secretion of the hormone ghrelin and by metabolic signals such as the secretion of the hormone insulin, which results in a drop in the body's blood glucose levels. How satiation and satiety occur. Satiation occurs when we have eaten enough food. Due to a delay between the swallowing and digesting of food, the body needs a short-term signal to indicate that it is time to stop consuming food, to prevent overeating. Research indicates that this quick-fix signal occurs as a mix of psychological, mechanical, and chemical factors. Psychological factors include something known as sensory-specific satiety, a term used to describe the decrease in satisfaction from eating more of the same substance, and thus a decrease in appetite due to the novelty of the taste wearing off. Mechanical factors include gastric distension, stretching of the stomach, which causes a sensation of fullness. Chemical factors include the taste and smell of food. This three-pronged effect helps us to feel full and, importantly, to cease eating before digestion of the meal is advanced. The state of satiety is achieved when certain levels of insulin, amino acids, and glucose are detected in the blood and by the oxidation of nutrients in the liver. When the level of these chemicals decreases, satiety does so too, and ultimately, hunger returns. Once again, satiety is largely hormonally regulated. The hormone cholecystokinin, which is produced when the gallbladder contracts, inhibits feelings of hunger. Perhaps the most important hormone related to satiety and inhibition of hunger, however, is leptin. This is produced by fat cells in the body. Therefore, theoretically, the more fat stores in the body, the more leptin is released, and the stronger the messages reaching the brain, causing inhibition of hunger and the further accumulation of excess fat stores. Sensory-specific satiety. Sensory-specific satiety results in a decrease in satisfaction when eating more of the same substance. The lack of novelty in the taste of the food being eaten leads to a decrease in appetite for that specific foodstuff. One study showed this phenomenon in practice when researchers asked adults to consume a glass of chocolate milk. After consuming the drink, they were asked to play a game whereby they could obtain either crisps or chocolate milk. Half were offered more chocolate milk and half some crisps. Those who were playing for more chocolate milk displayed a decreased liking of the taste and smell of chocolate milk and less motivation to obtain more when compared to the motivation and preferences of the group playing for crisps. Sensory-specific satiety in humans reflects a decrease in both food liking and food wanting and illustrates our preference for varied foods. This concept shows us the impact the sensory experience of eating can have, both positive and negative, on our appetites. Sensory-specific satiety also helps us to understand one way in which our thoughts, preferences, and sensory experience of a food can limit our hunger in the absence of true physiological satiety. The hormones of hunger and satiety. As mentioned previously, hunger and satiety are governed by chemical signals and their impact on the body. The following shows the basic effect on hunger levels of the most important eating-related hormones. Hormone, ghrelin. Action, sends messages to the brain to stimulate hunger and prepares the gastrointestinal tract for incoming food by increasing motility and gastric acid secretion. Effect on hunger, stimulates. Hormone, leptin. Action, signals to the brain that the body has enough stores of fat. Effect on hunger, inhibits. Hormone, insulin. Action, increasing levels of insulin causes a drop in the body's glucose levels. Effect on hunger, stimulates. Hormone, cholecystokinin. Action, decreases the rate of digestion. Effect on hunger, inhibits. Differentiating appetite from hunger. The following provides a brief overview of the differences between appetite and hunger and how an individual may respond to the sensations they arouse. Appetite, largely psychological process. Hunger, largely physiological process. Appetite, sudden onset, can be ignored if preoccupied with another activity. Hunger, gradual onset that slowly becomes more urgent. Appetite, desire for specific foods. Hunger, desire to eat often overrides food choice. Appetite, sensations are more in the mind and described as a yearning, longing, or craving. Hunger, accompanied by physical sensations such as a growling tummy and hunger pangs. Appetite, desire to eat is often not diminished once food has been consumed. Hunger, desire to eat again disappears for several hours after consuming food. Appetite, continuation of eating after a feeling of fullness because of enjoyment. Hunger, eating ceases once full. Appetite, emotions and food are strongly linked to each other. Hunger, no emotions involved. The most important message to take away when differentiating between hunger and appetite is that hunger is a physiological need, and appetite is an emotional want. While the two may occur together, they are very different, and understanding this is paramount when it comes to parents considering their children's eating habits. Gentle eating focuses on being mindful, or, put another way, eating for hunger. When we link emotions and eating, be that through rewarding, bribing, threatening, or shaming, we completely misunderstand how appetite and hunger work. Gentle eating must be free of emotion as much as possible, for both parent and child, in a way that also affords respect for the child's individual eating preferences or appetite. The psychology of appetite. While hunger and satiation and satiety are predominantly physiological, appetite, in contrast, has a large psychological component. Appetite can really be summarized as food wants, and very often, these can overshadow food needs. If eating was based on need only, the world would not be experiencing such a rising obesity problem. The psychological processes that distinguish appetite from hunger are one of the keys for parents who wish to move towards a more gentle, mindful, and respectful view of their children's eating. Appetite encompasses a broad array of variables, such as individual taste preferences, sensory likes and dislikes, temperature preferences, preferring to eat food hot, cold, or lukewarm, visual appeal, aroma, the amount of same food consumed, memories and emotions linked to previous experiences of specific foods, the social aspect, for instance, sharing food with friends, learned behavior surrounding food, for instance, the idea that certain food should be eaten at specific times of the day, learned beliefs about food, that certain food is good or bad, for example. These thought processes can and do overshadow hunger, affecting whether we choose to eat when we are not hungry, or not eat when we are. The hunger-satiety cycle. A summary. Before we consider how aspects of our modern-day lives impact on our physiology and the regulation of eating, I thought it would be a good idea to sum up what we have covered so far in this chapter. The following shows the cycle of hunger, satiation, and satiety, and the different hormonal changes involved at each point. Remember, hunger is not the same as appetite, although appetite plays a role in the seeking, choice of, and continuation or cessation of eating food. The hunger-satiety cycle. Hunger. Emptiness of stomach detected along with lowered levels of nutrients in the intestines. Gastric cramping occurs, known commonly as hunger pangs. Hormone ghrelin released. This leads to seek food, begin eating. Sensory influences on choice of food, including the smell, taste, and sight of certain foods. Thought processes and memories affect our choices. This leads to continue eating. Cognitive influences on the amount we eat include eating in the presence of others, the time of day, our relationship with food, and our liking of certain foods. This leads to satiation, cease eating. Sensory specific satiety. Stretch receptors in gut sense fullness. Nutrients detected in intestines. This leads to satiety. Glucose, amino acids, and insulin levels in blood reduce hunger. Feeling of fullness remains. Ghrelin levels decrease. Leptin inhibits feelings of hunger. This leads back to hunger. The physiology of taste. The sense of taste, or gustation to give it its official name, helps to drive our appetite and enables us to stay safe by protecting us from poisonous foodstuffs. We innately prefer savory, salty, and sweet tastes over bitter and sour ones, most likely because the latter two are more commonly found in foods that are toxic to us. Our sense of taste develops over time, however, due to a blend of repeated exposure and maturing cognitive abilities, when we learn that not all bitter and sour tastes are a threat to our survival. This idea is one I will examine in much more detail in Chapter 5, when we look at toddler and preschooler eating. Our sense of taste occurs in taste receptor cells, 50 to 150 of which are contained in our individual taste buds. Our taste receptor cells send messages about the sensation of taste to the brainstem, which, in turn, controls whether we continue or stop eating a particular foodstuff, as well as triggering a chain of events to aid digestion, such as an increase in salivation. Most of our taste buds are found in small bumps on the surface of the tongue, called papillae, and while the tongue's papillae are visible to the naked eye, taste buds are not. While previously it was believed that different areas of the tongue are responsible for different tastes, these maps have now been shown to be inaccurate, with taste buds not having such clear boundaries. The sensation of taste is an individual experience. Some people will respond more strongly to certain tastes, while others simply seem to taste more strongly. This genetic difference is, in part, due to the number of papillae and taste buds found on the tongue, with more being found in those who experience stronger taste sensations. Around a quarter of the population are known as supertasters, the supertaster gene appearing to amplify the taste of food, especially bitter tastes. There are 5 known specific tastes experienced by humans. Bitter. Examples include coffee and high cocoa content dark chocolate. Bitter tastes also commonly occur in plants or animals that are toxic. Salty. Examples include food in brine. Salty tastes allow the body to regulate the balance of electrolytes. Sour. Examples include lemons, limes, and vinegar. Sourness allows the body to detect acid levels in foods. Sweet. Examples include honey and fruits. Sweetness usually indicates foods rich in energy content. Umami. Examples include cheese, meat, and foods containing monosodium glutamate. Umami usually indicates the presence of amino acids. The sense of taste is also impacted by the sense of smell, and it is the combination of events in the mouth, nose, and brain that gives us the flavor of a food. Contrary to popular belief, strong cravings for a specific taste or food are rooted firmly in psychology and not physiology, and do not indicate a deficiency of a certain nutrient. Rather, cravings occur because of our experiences, emotions, and memories surrounding food. This is an idea we will return to again in Chapter 2. The effect of sleep on hunger and appetite. Eating and sleep have a strong relationship. What we eat can affect our sleep, and our sleep, in turn, can affect what we eat. Foods that are rich in the amino acid tryptophan aid the onset of sleep. Tryptophan is one of the building blocks of serotonin, a neurotransmitter that helps to modulate the sleep-wake cycle in the brain, as well as regulating emotional stability. Imbalances in serotonin levels can, therefore, result in disrupted circadian rhythms, otherwise known as body clocks, as well as a lack of emotional stability. Tryptophan is commonly found in eggs, poultry, whole wheat, and nuts. Food can inhibit sleep too, the most common culprit being caffeine, which acts as a stimulant and sleep suppressor. Earlier in this chapter, we considered the effect of the hormones ghrelin and leptin on hunger and satiety. Ghrelin stimulates hunger, while leptin inhibits it. Ordinarily, when we sleep, leptin levels increase, which helps us to stay asleep for several hours, without waking as a result of hunger. Less sleep, however, means less leptin is secreted, and higher levels of ghrelin circulate in the body, stimulating hunger. If sleep deprivation continues, leptin levels will remain low, while ghrelin levels rise. This imbalance causes an increase in hunger, despite the body not needing fuel, which can lead to weight gain or difficulty in losing excess weight. Research shows an increased risk of obesity in both children and adults with consistently short sleep periods. This concept is of great importance when thinking about teenagers who tend to get less sleep at night towards the end of primary school or the start of secondary school. This sleep reduction is in part due to a change in their circadian rhythms and a shift towards later sleep onset. a pattern that is clearly at odds with school start times. We cannot, however, discount the impact of screens and their use by older children at night. Coupled with the shift in body clocks, this can give us a potential explanation for rising levels of obesity in adolescents. This idea, and how to tackle it, is examined in some depth in Chapter 7. The effect of stress on hunger and appetite. Like sleep deprivation, stress can have a similar hunger-stimulating effect on the body. Admittedly, short-term stress has a limited inhibitory effect on hunger, thanks to the fight-or-flight response, which causes us not to want to eat if we are anxious or nervous about something. Chronic, long-lasting stress, on the other hand, can drive the body to eat more due to the secretion of the stress hormone cortisol. Usually, cortisol levels fall back to normal at the end of a stressful event. However, in some cases, the stressor may remain, and so too the stress response, which, in turn, can cause the hormone ghrelin to be elevated, triggering hunger. Research has also found that the high ghrelin levels that accompany stress may help us to cope with any resulting anxiety and depression. Cortisol can also cause individuals, particularly females, to crave high-fat and high-sugar foods. This effect may have a small physiological component, as well as the more common psychological one. High-fat and high-sugar foods can have a slight numbing effect on the part of the brain that is responsible for producing stress and anxiety. Stress-related eating also has a strong psychological component, with learned reactions, memories, and conditioned responses. If a person learns that cake is used to palliate stress in childhood, the chances are they will continue to eat cake when stressed in adulthood, even if the cake has no physiological effects on their body's stress response. This is an important point that we will return to in Chapter 2. These new insights into the physiology and psychology of eating mean it is necessary to take a much more holistic approach. Eating encompasses many variables, and these must be understood if we want to make a positive change to our children's relationship with food, or start them off on the most positive path. It is not as simple as previous generations have made out. New understandings in science mean that we must move on from the outdated behaviorist approaches to eating that hinge on praise, reward, and consequences, those that involve giving a sticker if a child nibbles on a Brussels sprout, or sending them to bed hungry if they turn their nose up at dinner. Everything is interlinked: biology, emotions, and sleep. We must also consider eating from an evolutionary perspective. While science moves on quickly, evolution does so much more slowly. What, if any, eating practices, especially those exhibited by children, may hark back to a different era? Are these evolutionary kickbacks wrong, just because they don't fit into our modern-day view of eating? This is a question that we will come back to throughout the following chapters, particularly in Chapter 5, when we look at eating in 1 to 4-year-olds. To close this chapter, I would like to remind you of the 4 basic tenets of gentle eating. It is mindful, empowering, respectful, and authoritative. We have seen how appetite, hunger, satiation, and satiety are governed by psychological and physiological components, which is why the mindful aspect of gentle eating is so important. In order to help our children to eat mindfully, we should empower them to trust their own bodily cues via an authoritative and respectful parenting style. These last 3 tenets of gentle eating are all interwoven and interdependent, and each is as important as the other. We must understand the full spectrum of eating influences to fulfill these gentle eating goals with our children. We've looked at some of the physiological influences at play with your child's eating. In Chapter 2, we will look at some of the psychological influences that affect how, what, and when children eat, starting with the biggest psychological influence of all. You. Chapter 2. They are what we eat. Adult eating and why it matters. You may be wondering why this book includes a chapter on adult eating when you are concerned about your child's, not your own. You may also be tempted to skip this chapter and go straight to the one appropriate for your child's age. There is, however, a very good reason why it is not only included in this book, but also appears before those concerned with children's eating. Because if we want to improve the latter, we must make sure that we, as adults, are setting a good example. Sadly, most of us do anything but. Many of the worries we have about our children's eating are rooted in our own disordered eating and dysfunctional beliefs. If our aim is to help our children to follow a gentle eating ethos, one that is mindful, empowering, respectful, and authoritative, we must follow the same rules ourselves. Before we can even begin to tackle any eating-related concerns with our children, we must work with our own. Otherwise, we will pass them on, or create new problems based on them in our children. We may even learn that what we believe to be their issues are in fact our own, and they are eating entirely normally. This is why this chapter is included, and why it comes before the others. Please do take the time to listen to it. Your relationship with food. How do you feel about your eating? Do you feel that it is under control? Do you feel relaxed around food? Are you happy with your body? Do you feel that your relationship with food is healthy? Or do you feel that there are elements of eating that you struggle with as an adult? How would you feel if your child grew up with the same thoughts and feelings about their body and eating as you? If any of these questions leave you feeling a little uncomfortable, then it is especially important for you to listen to this chapter, in order that you can try to avoid passing on any of your own unhealthy beliefs to your child. If, however, you feel that you have a good relationship with eating and with your body, then this chapter may serve to highlight why this is, and how you can pass on your own positive thoughts to your children, avoiding common pitfalls that may appear over the next few years. Either way, this must be your starting point. Whether you are coming from a position of reading and preparation, without any specific worries or concerns, or you are looking for solutions to specific problems that you have with your child's eating. Hangovers from childhood. Many of our beliefs and behaviors surrounding eating stem from our own childhoods. Often, they are a conditioned response to something that happened decades ago. Eating and food are commonly intertwined with our childhood memories, both good and bad. As parents, as much as we think we may be, or indeed hope to be, we are not objective about food and eating, and we may subconsciously influence our children and their eating as a result. While we can't change what happened to us, we can recognize its impact and be mindful of it, so as not to repeat the cycle again and again. Think back to food in your own childhood and the roles of your parents, grandparents, school dinner ladies, or other adults. Collectively, I call these individuals the food police. I suspect you had quite a few of them in your life when you were growing up. Do you remember hearing them say any of the following? Good girl, you ate all your dinner. Well done, what a lovely clean plate. Come on, eat up, there are children starving in Africa. Just one bite, it won't kill you. Eat your crusts up, they make your hair curl. If you don't eat your carrots, you won't be able to see in the dark. No pudding for you if you don't eat up your dinner. Don't eat that now, you'll spoil your appetite. Just one more mouthful, then you can have some ice cream. You're such a good girl. You've got such a healthy appetite. You're not getting down from this table unless you finish your food. If you don't eat it, then you'll go straight to your room and be hungry. If you eat that, your teeth will rot and fall out. If you don't finish your meal, you won't get a treat. Eat up quickly, otherwise your brother will eat it for you. Cheer up, stop crying. Here's a nice chocolate bar to help you feel better. Some of these statements may bring up uncomfortable memories of your childhood, and may even begin to remind you of how some of your own eating behaviors have been formed. Becoming mindful of the subconscious drivers of your own eating behavior is a significant stepping stone towards following and achieving gentle eating principles. But even if none of these statements rings a bell for you, being aware of the impact of your own words and those of any other adults who care for your child is important in order to help prevent any emotional eating issues from developing. Awareness, being mindful, is always an incredibly important first step towards adopting a gentle eating mindset. I was a good girl when I was a child. I ate a lot of food, wasn't especially picky about what I ate, cleared my plate, and rarely let anything go to waste, and I was regularly praised for it. My self-esteem was quite strongly tied to being a good eater. I felt proud of my eating, and eating, as a result, made me feel good. Can you tell where this is going? Fast forward 30 years or so, and I struggle with regulating my eating. I eat to make myself feel better when I'm sad or stressed, just as I was encouraged to do as a child. Eating is how I make myself feel good. It has also taken me many years to overcome the guilt of leaving food on my plate, especially a substantial amount. I finally resolved the wastage issue by getting chickens, which eat pretty much any food that is left over in our house. I still feel pangs of guilt if I must discard food when we're away from home, though. The emotional eating has taken much longer and much more work on my behalf to undo. I know where my food issues stem from, but they are so hard to overcome. Once you understand why you behave the way you do around food, you can then begin to change the deeply ingrained patterns. But what if you don't, or can't, change them? Well, you risk passing them on to your own children, and, in turn, any future grandchildren, and so on. Emotional eating and the link with reward. Do you ever eat out of sadness, anxiety, or boredom? The British often say that a good cup of tea helps solve everything. For many, however, that cup of tea is accompanied by a couple of biscuits, a bar of chocolate, or a slice of cake. It is no surprise, then, that so many of us turn to sugary treats to console ourselves because we were placated by them in childhood. Food can be a quick, easy, and superficially successful way for parents to keep a lid on children's emotions. Sweets and chocolate are often used to quieten and distract toddlers about to tantrum, children who have fallen and hurt themselves, and even teenagers who are upset about falling out with a friend. But what happens over the years when that child learns to rely on eating to achieve an emotional status quo? Eating stops being mindful. It is no longer solely a response to hunger. Physical satiety is overridden by a lack of emotional satiety, and disordered eating becomes a way of life. Research has shown that children are drawn to high-fat and sugary foods when their parents use food to regulate their emotions or as a reward for certain behavior. While the link between regulating children's emotions with foods and the development of emotional eating may be fairly obvious, many parents aren't aware of the connection between using food as a reward and emotional eating. The basics of both, however, are the same. Using food to help children feel good, whether that is a lollipop given to stop them crying after a fall or a chocolate bar given as a reward for a job well done, creates a relationship for them between eating and feelings. Put simply, if children are used to associating food with feeling good or feeling better, it is no surprise that as they grow up, they eat when they are experiencing uncomfortable emotions. And the food chosen to override sadness, anxiety, or stress will always be one that is associated with being a treat or reward. Scientists are clear that using food as a reward in childhood increases the risk of disordered and emotional eating as the child grows. It isn't only children, however, who are rewarded with food. Adults often are too. Can you remember a time when you have been to a restaurant or food shop with your children in tow and have declared that you are going to treat yourself, perhaps for being good? These are the sorts of behaviors and self-talk that children pick up on. If they see you using food as a treat for yourself, even if you don't use it to treat them, they may still develop a form of emotional eating. Unfortunately, rewarding with food or using it to regulate emotions is rife in our society, for both children and adults. One of the keys for preventing emotional eating developing in childhood is to understand it and stop it. Giving food a personality. The problem with labeling. Many adults tend to anthropomorphize food or ascribe human traits to it. The classic here is calling food good or naughty. These and other similar labels don't belong to food, however. They are figments of our imagination and a projection of our conditioned, disordered beliefs surrounding eating. The same is true of the words healthy and unhealthy, These terms should be used to describe the whole of a person's diet and attitude to food, not specific parts of them. Cake is not unhealthy. Vegetables are not healthy. It is the amount of them that we eat, how often we eat them, and in what combination that is. There is an interesting psychological effect caused by our beliefs and labeling of so-called healthy foods, known as the health halo effect. This occurs when we believe that a food which may have some healthy aspects is completely virtuous. For instance, we may believe that something labeled organic is healthier than it is because of the organic label. Research conducted in Germany looking at the impact of labeling on behavior found that foods with healthy labels had a very different impact on people who were trying to lose weight. Researchers found that the study participants ate significantly more trail mix when it carried the label fitness snack rather than just trail mix. In addition, when participants were given the opportunity to use an exercise bike, those who had eaten the trail mix with the fitness label exercised less than those who had consumed the same food labeled just trail mix, somehow believing that they needed to exercise less if they had eaten a food intended for fitness, even though they had consumed more. Why does this matter, you may ask? It matters because the way in which we, as adults, label and anthropomorphize food has a direct influence on how our children view it, and, by extension, on how and what they eat. Research into the eating habits of 4- and 5-year-olds has found that children are less likely to eat something if it carries an outcome-based label, indicating that it is good for them in some way, whether literally, i.e. on the packaging, or via caregivers. For instance, if they are told a certain food makes you strong or helps you to read. The research also found that if a food is labeled as being good for them, children believe that it must therefore be less tasty. This sort of labeling doesn't just affect our psychology, though. Unbelievably, it can also affect our physiological response to food. Researchers from Yale University in the USA conducted an experiment with a group of 46 adult volunteers. The participants were asked to attend 2 sessions at a hospital research unit, a week apart, to help test some new milkshakes that were being developed with different nutrient contents. On both visits, they were given an identical milkshake containing 380 calories, although they were told they were different. On one visit, they were informed that the milkshake was a high-fat, high-calorie, indulgent one, containing 620 calories. And on the other, they were told that they were being given a low-fat, low-calorie, sensible milkshake containing 140 calories. Half of the participants received the sensible milkshake first, while half received the indulgent milkshake first. In both cases, participants were asked to consume the milkshake in its entirety within 10 minutes. Once they had done so, researchers measured their ghrelin levels, the hunger hormone, at 3 different points in time. What they found was astounding. Those who had consumed the indulgent milkshake showed steep declines in ghrelin levels and said that they felt fuller for longer. Those who had consumed the sensible milkshake had a much smaller drop in ghrelin levels and reported feeling less full. The results of this experiment prove the amazing power of mindset and belief when it comes to our eating behavior. There is one last way in which adults use food-related labeling, and this is perhaps the most concerning of all. Calling children cupcake, sweetie pie, treacle, and the like indicates to them that sweet foods are the ones to aspire to. None of us calls our children little cauliflower or beef casserole. What effect does this have on our children's preferences? There is a strong chance that they will favor those foods we use to positively identify them. If we want our children to have a healthy relationship with food, it makes sense not to use foodstuffs as terms of endearment. Avoiding food labels and being mindful, one of the 4 basic tenets of gentle eating, around food, means we and our children can take more control over the eating experience. Respect, another important tenet of gentle eating, allows our children to have individual choice and preferences, rather than us unwittingly passing on our own tastes or inhibiting or encouraging eating via labeling. This labeling is often deeply ingrained in us, usually stemming back to our own childhoods. It takes time to undo, but being aware, or mindful, of it is a great starting point. The social niceties and norms of eating. Whenever I'm running a question and answer session with parents, I'm almost always asked the following questions. How do I get my child to eat dinner? She just won't eat in the evening. How do I get my child to eat his main meal before his dessert? My daughter will only eat cornflakes for dinner. How do I get her to eat what we're eating? In each of these scenarios, I ask the parents to consider what exactly their problem is, and most importantly, who has that problem? After some discussion, the answers always come down to adult expectations. As adults, much of our eating is uninstinctive. We eat according to the clock, not our hunger, and we eat to socially prescribed rules, not our appetite. The real problem comes when we expect our children to follow our own unnatural eating practices. Take, for example, choice of foods. Who decided that cornflakes should only be eaten first thing in the morning? Why can't they be eaten in the afternoon or evening? What makes them a suitable breakfast food, yet an unsuitable offering for lunch or dinner? What would happen if you ate a sandwich in the morning and cornflakes for lunch? The answer is obviously nothing. So why are we so fixated on breakfast food, lunch food, and dinner food? The same goes for a main meal and dessert. Why can't dessert come first, or at the same time as the main meal? Certainly, if it did, we would lose the labelling of the main meal being healthy and something that must be eaten before the unhealthy dessert. Another unwritten rule is about when we eat and how much is eaten at what time. As adults, we tend to eat 3 times a day, breakfast, lunch and dinner, with perhaps 1 or 2 small snacks in between. Our evening meal is almost always the biggest meal of the day, aside from on Sundays, perhaps, when it is common to eat the main meal of the day at lunchtime. Usual times to eat are 7 a.m, between 12 and 2 p.m, and anywhere between 5 and 8 p.m. This pattern of eating, however, is not mindful, nor is it particularly instinctive. As adults, we have learned to ignore our hunger and satiety signals, and to eat instead at prescribed times. We eat if we're not hungry if it is a mealtime, we don't eat when we are hungry if it is not a mealtime, and we save most of our eating for the evening. When children come along, and they want to eat their lunch at 10 a.m, followed by a huge meal at 2 p.m, and then nothing else until the next morning, we think their eating is problematic. We stress over them not eating dinner or eating too much in the morning. The sad reality is, however, that we are the abnormal eaters, not our children, who eat when they are hungry, regardless of when that is, and stop when they are full, even if that satiety clashes with a mealtime. We, as adults, override the signals our bodies are giving us, eating by the clock and long-held, undisputed social rules. Perhaps we could learn something from the more mindful and instinctive eating of our children, rather than trying to shape them to fit our own non-mindful eating patterns. Adult body image and mirroring negative self-talk. Our own body image has a powerful impact on our eating behaviours. In Chapter 1, we learned how stress affects eating. Persistent feelings of a lack of self-worth or body hatred often result in uncomfortable, stressful feelings. This stress can cause us either to overeat or to restrict our eating in a quest to lose weight and feel better about ourselves. Either way, a negative body image and disordered eating often go hand in hand. How you feel about your own body matters hugely to your children. They are not exempt from the impact of body image, which can, and does, have as much impact on them as it does on us. If you talk about being fat, wanting to lose weight, your gross, wobbly tummy and big bottom, or your ugly stretch marks in front of your children, you demonstrate to them how to judge their own bodies. If you, as an adult, are hypercritical of your appearance, you teach them to behave in the same way towards their own bodies. Research has shown that parental body image, particularly the mother's, has an impact on that of children as young as 4 and remains a strong influencer throughout adolescence, especially for girls. If you want your child to be happy in his or her own skin and appreciative of what they have, then you must start learning to accept your own body. A tough call in a world full of celebrity culture, cosmetic surgery, Botox, social media, and photoshopped images. To help our children grow up with self-esteem, independent of their looks, we first need to break free of the trend ourselves. Changing our language is a good starting point. The British actress Kate Winslet was once asked in an interview about body image and how she influences her daughter, Mia. She replied,